Welcome to the Ephesiology Podcast in our series, Archaeology Meets Missiology, the Mission of God in the Records of Time. Today we have Michael, our resident ephesiologist, and I'm Andrew Johnson in Houston, Texas. Today we have the distinct privilege to be joined by Dr. Mark Fairchild. Dr. Fairchild is a retired professor from Huntington University, and he had a focus in biblical archaeological research in Asia Minor. So what does that look like? Well, since joining the faculty at HU, Dr. Fairchild has made numerous academic contributions to biblical research, including his book, The Underwater Basilica of Nicaea, Archaeology in the Birthplace of Christian Theology. That came out this year. He also wrote Christian Origins in Ephesus and Asia Minor in 2015, and the forthcoming book, The Enslavement of Paul, The Early Life of Saul the Zealot. That is coming out next year. Now, if you haven't read his books, maybe you have seen him. He has a documentary called The Last Apostle on Amazon Prime, as he retraced the course of Paul's journeys through Cyprus and Anatolia. He also was a participant in a series on PBS, Secrets of the Dead, Season 20. Episode 5, The Sunken Basilica. I know you have that as a listener. You have that season memorized, that series memorized. So I hope that you understand how important it is for us to be joined by Dr. Fairchild. So Mark, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Andrew. And thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to share with you and with your audience. And God has done great things, and looking forward to our discussion.
Yeah, we are too, Mark, and I'm grateful for you to join us. You know, I first came across you, I think, watching that documentary, The First Apostle, and what struck me, and I would love to hear some of your story in your archaeological journeys, but what struck me was that here is a guy that's trekking around places where nobody probably has trekked in 1,000 or more years, looking for these incredible discoveries of the presence of Judaism and Christianity in the back hills of Anatolia. So you are like the true Christian Indiana Jones, if there ever were one.
Well, don't get me started. I ramble, but I have been going to Turkey for more than 25 years. A lot of people don't realize how important Turkey is biblically. This is what I call the cradle of Christianity. Even though Christianity began in Israel, we can call that the birthplace of Christianity. It was soon pushed out of Israel, and it found its primary home in what is today Turkey, ancient Anatolia. It's where approximately two-thirds of the New Testament was written, either from or to churches in Turkey. All seven churches in the book of Revelation are in Turkey. All seven ecumenical councils, one of which we're going to be talking about here, the Council of Nicaea, took place in Turkey. I could go on and on and on, but Turkey's a fascinating place. And what has really attracted me to Turkey is the fact that 20, 30 years ago, not much research was actually taking place in Turkey. And I was wondering why. And I think one of the reasons is Turkey itself has never really welcomed Christian scholars and archaeologists, with the exception of the Germans. Mm. The Germans had coddled a very close relationship with the Ottomans. And so the Germans were able to get in there early. But outside of that, Turkey is relatively unexplored. And so that is what brought me back to Turkey time and time again, is the discoveries that are there in Turkey. And I've been fortunate. God, I think, has blessed me with opportunities, and I've opened myself up to avail myself of those opportunities. So it's been a terrific ride.
Yeah. So, and it's not finished. I love that. It's not Great. Well, we're going to get into your most recent book, the Underwater Basilica at Nicaea, because I know that that has taken a lot of your attention, and that's one of the opportunities that you've been afforded in relationship with a Turkish university. But outside of that, Give us just a little bit of flavor of what are some of the most significant things that you've come across in your various adventures in Turkey.
You know, people have often asked me the question, what's my favorite place? And you need to put an end at the end of that. Places.
Yeah.
And there's dozens of them. It's hard for me to pick them out. But I think one of my favorite areas is a place called Rough Cilicia. Now, as you know, of course, Paul came from Tarsus, which is in the Roman province of Cilicia. And Cilicia is divided into two sections. The northeast section is called Smooth Cilicia. But when we get into the southwest area of Cilicia, I wish I had a map, I could show you this. It is very mountainous. The Taurus Mountain Range runs very close to the coastal areas, and it's cut deep canyons that have drop-offs as many as 1,200 feet, 800 feet to the canyon.
Whoa!
And it is incredibly beautiful, unbelievably beautiful. And what is really interesting about this section is people settled up into these inhospitable, scarcely accessible places of Rough Cilicia. Mm-hmm. And this is where Paul spent 7 to 9 years after his conversion. He was sent back to Tarsus. And between Acts chapter 9 and Acts chapter 11, verse 25, when Barnabas comes and searches for Paul, he didn't find him in Tarsus, searches for Paul, he brought him back to Syrian Antioch. And Paul was doing ministry. This is where he learned the gospel, learned his theology. Paul, when writing to the Galatians, describes this as a revelation. Mm-hmm. The Greek word there is apokalypsis, the same word that is used in the book of Revelation. And this is what Paul talks about when writing to the Corinthians. He says, 14 years ago, I received this revelation. The apocalypse, he uses that same term. Mm-hmm. Well, if we do the math, 14 years from when Paul wrote that letter to the Corinthians puts us smack dab in the middle of that 7 to 9 year period of time. Wow. So when you ask me about favorite places, this is one of the places that I'm particularly attracted to. I've been there for at least 2 weeks every year for the last 16 years.
Wow.
It's an amazing place. There's lots of that story.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And so when you say that Barnabas was searching for Paul, this wasn't like walking around the streets of some city looking in houses, but he's literally, it sounds like, he's
searching
climbing
through the canyons.
Yeah, he's climbing mountain ranges and searching through canyons.
Well, you know, as Acts 9 tells us, he was sent back to Tarsus, which is the capital city of Cilicia, okay? Barnabas probably went to Tarsus and started asking around. And people were probably saying, well, he isn't here. Where is he? Well, he went down probably into Rough Cilicia is what I hypothesize. Huh. And incidentally, after this book on Paul the Slave, that's my next volume. I'm going to be talking about Paul's journeys in Rough Cilicia.
Oh, great.
And how can we identify places that he may have visited?
Yeah. Wow. I remember reading William Ramsay and him saying, if you really want to get a sense, saying something to the effect that if you really want to get a sense for the book of Acts, that you need to breathe the air that they breathe, to walk the geography that they walked. And you've done that, right? Is Ramsay correct?
If you really want to, You see, Ramsay wrote at a time when the German Heilsgeschichte school, led by the Tübingen scholars, were really scoffing at the historicity of the Acts of the Apostles. And Ramsay himself believed that story until he invested himself in Turkey, began to travel to Turkey, do his research there, and he completely changed perspectives. He realized that Luke is writing credible history. And even since Ramsay's writings, okay, there's that faction of scholarship that still denigrates the historicity of Turkey and the Acts of the Apostles. And so one of the things that I'm doing and one of the things that we're now discovering as more and more scholars, archaeologists are now flooding into Turkey, it's become very popular. We're discovering that, you know what, the Acts of the Apostles is quite credible.
Mm.
And what we read here can be affirmed with discoveries that are being made in the land of Anatolia.
So you can
so
literally open the book of Acts and use it as a roadmap, can't you?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Luke, don't get me wrong. Luke has a lot of gaps in his story. You know, for instance, Luke doesn't say a word about that 7 to 9 year period of Paul in Rough Cilicia. What I argue in the next book that I'm writing is that this was actually Paul's first mission. You know, we think about Paul's three missionary journeys, and lots of times we call the first mission that went to Cyprus, Pamphylia, and Galatia, yeah. We call that the first missionary journey. Well, it wasn't.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Paul spent
that's just the first
7 to 9 years, 7 to 9 years in Cilicia. And that's twice as long as any of Paul's journeys that are recorded in Acts.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Wow.
That's fascinating. So as I'm listening to you and remembering being in Turkey and what I was able to see, 15, 16, no, 17 years ago.
How do you know? Back. I mean, a lot has changed.
Please don't tempt me. Michael has already been trying to tempt me. My wife and I we would love to be back in Istanbul as well as Turkey at large. We love that country. But that's aside from that, when you talk about going to these areas and you talk about using the Bible as a roadmap and getting to these places, and I am going to be a little bit cheeky. How do you know that, you know, Paul was there, or what Luke describes these Acts of the Apostles were there? Did they walk around and sign their names? You know, did they put graffiti that they, you know, I was here, Luke was here, and he spelled it all crazy? Like, how do we know? Yes, they were here. We're moving beyond hypothesis. How would you help people understand that there is proof in the archaeological record of these things that we read?
For most of these cities, they have been identified primarily with inscriptions. So the inscriptions themselves, I can take you back and show you inscriptions that mention the name of these cities and towns. So we match that, of course, with what we read in the Acts of the Apostles. The other thing is, we know a little bit about Paul's missionary strategy. So, for instance, if I go back to talking about Paul's real first mission, the mission that Paul had in Rough Cilicia, Paul tells us that he prioritized ministry to Jewish communities.
Mm-hmm.
Romans chapter 1, what does Paul say? I'm not ashamed of the gospel. It's the power of God for salvation for everyone who believes. And then he said, to the Jew first. And secondarily, of course, to the Gentiles. If you read in the Acts of the Apostles, Paul always goes to the synagogue first. He doesn't go to the agora, where most people would assemble together. He doesn't go to the bathhouse. He goes to the synagogue. Even in Luke, when Luke is in Macedonia, Luke says, as was Paul's custom, he goes to the synagogue. So the point to be made is, if we can identify Jewish locations, and this is what I'm concentrating on as I write this volume on Paul's ministry in Rough Cilicia. If we can identify places where there was a Jewish presence, I think we can conclude with a high degree of probability that Paul was there. No, so you know, to answer your question, no, Paul didn't autograph stones. Things, remains that can be identified. The other factor that I think is very important is, in this area of Rough Cilicia, we have some of the earliest Byzantine churches anywhere in the world, including Israel, okay? The fact that you've got some of the earliest Byzantine churches is, I think, proof of the fact that this is where Christianity found, well, a home that was pushed out of Palestine.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Wow. Neat. Well, so much we can get into around this topic, but we want to spend some time talking about your book. This was fascinating to me. I came across it just a couple months ago. It's just come out recently. and started reading it. I thought, I can't put this down. This is so fascinating to read, not just as a story of early Christianity, but as, but really an adventure of learning and verifying some of our long history. So I know you introduced the book. You talk about, I believe, having received a Fulbright scholarship for this research, and your development of a relationship with an archaeological team there. Tell us about how you got started in the research on this underwater basilica.
Well, as I've mentioned, I travel around Turkey every year. I visit many sites, and on one occasion, I went up to Nicaea. And Nicaea is a beautiful ancient city. Even aside from the interest that one might draw from the underwater basilica, it's got a 3-mile wall that is in excellent shape. It's just incredible. It's got gates that date back to victory arches, with the first century victory arches of Vespasian.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful theater there. There's a lot to see in the city. But at any rate, I had visited the city, and while there, I met Mustafa Shaheen. Mustafa Shaheen is the director of excavations at Nicaea. Actually, when we talk about Nicaea, it's the modern city of Iznik.
Uh-huh.
And we struck up a relationship, and soon after that, he asked if I'd collaborate with him. So I began to work with him. In 2018, we jointly published a preliminary article for the Biblical Archaeology Review and continued with this relationship. And I was selected for a Fulbright scholarship where I could spend more time, had more resources at my fingertips. And Mustafa Shaheen has been terrific. I mean, he has really helped and assisted along with the archaeology team. And so that has led to this.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. Tell us a little bit. Why Nicaea? Why is that city so important?
Well, it's important for a couple of reasons. You know, as I describe in the book, an early saint was martyred there, and the structure, the submerged basilica, is actually outside of the city. People don't build churches, don't build basilicas outside of the city. Okay, so first of all, that, you know, asks some question. Why is it that this is built as it is? You'll also discover that there are 36 tombs, 18 of them outside of the basilica, another 18 of them inside of the basilica. But why do you have so many tombs out and around a church? The reason for that is this originated as a martyrium, and that is a church that was constructed at the place of a person's martyrdom.
Hmm.
And it commemorates and remembers the sacrifice of this martyr. So it's important for that reason. But probably the reason why it really resonates in the minds of most Christians is because, of course, the Council of Nicaea and the Nicene Creed that was written there.
Mm-hmm.
Nicaea became very important. There were 7 ecumenical councils, and these were instances where the worldwide church, and of course, when we talk about worldwide back in those days, we're talking about the Mediterranean world.
I would say a little smaller than full world, but yeah.
Right. But it's the first time that bishops, the leaders, the theologians from across the Mediterranean were brought together to iron out issues. You know, one of the problems, I think, that we have in churches today is because it's become fractured.
Yeah.
We have so many denominations, Orthodox, Catholic, Protestants, and even among those large branches of Christianity, you have, you know, so many different Protestant churches.
Yeah.
We tend to disagree on minor issues. This was an instance where the unity of the church was important. And Constantine, of course, called together bishops, theologians, leaders of the church to resolve these issues. It's important for that reason.
Yeah.
It's also important because it marks a point in time where the church emerged from the underground to now operate openly with imperial sanction. The Edict of Milan in 313 AD was a monumental movement within the history of Christianity. Prior to the Edict of Milan, Christianity was persecuted. So for 250 years, Christianity was bitterly persecuted. Now, it was sporadic, but not like unabated persecution, but bitterly persecuted, and many people were martyred. Now, after the Edict of Milan, Christianity became legal. Property that previously had been seized was returned to Christians, and Christianity now operates above ground. Instead of functioning discreetly, now it's open, and it has imperial sanction. So a very important movement.
Yeah, yeah, great. Well, that's such a great overview of how important that city was at the time period of their legalization, if you will, of Christianity. But even prior to that, as you mentioned, the martyrarium, and particularly there was one saint there martyred that seems to have caught your attention.
Well,
tell us a bit about him.
For catching my attention, really, Mustafa Shaheen believes that the martyr entombed within that church, within the basilica, is a fellow by the name of Neophutos. According to tradition, Neophutos was martyred in 303 BC, shortly, a decade before the Edict of Milan. I wouldn't stake my life on that. I'm not throwing stones. I would say, of all the candidates, he's the one that's most plausible. Okay. But somebody, some martyr, and I would throw out Neophutos as being the most likely candidate of those, was probably executed on the shores of Lake Iznik. In the past, it was called Lake Iskania. We have a, for this film that you had mentioned, the documentary that was on PBS, they brought me to Rome, to the Vatican Library. And in the Vatican Library, they have what is called a Menologion. A Menologion is a calendar, and for each day, they have a saint, and they tell the story of this saint. And the Vatican Menologion has, on one of these pages, the story of Neophutos. And what's interesting is the Menologion not only has the story, but it also has an illustrated panel. And there on that panel, you can see that his execution took place on the shore of the lake, which makes an interesting connection.
Yeah, it certainly
and
does.
That would account for why this is a church that is outside of the walls of Nicaea.
Yeah, wow.
There are 14 other churches that have been discovered, Byzantine churches that have been discovered in Nicaea. All 14 of them are inside of the city. This is the only one outside of the city. And of the 14 other Byzantine churches in Nicaea, none of them date as early as the 4th century. This one dates to the 4th century.
Okay.
So there's a lot of interesting connections there.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And so the title of the book is Underwater Basilica. It's underwater. How did that happen? Talk a little bit about that and even the challenges that presents to archaeology.
Yeah, I'm not a seismologist, but doing research for this, I've learned a lot about seismology. And
I would say, you got a minor in it?
I wouldn't go that far. Seismologists describe the Anatolian plate, which occupies most of Turkey, as the most active seismic plate on the Earth. So it's very much active. Your readers will be interested. Remember that a year and a half ago, there were two earthquakes in eastern Turkey that totally destroyed Antakya, which ancient Antioch, Syrian Antioch. This is where Barnabas and Paul began their missions. And it completely destroyed the city. I've been there twice, actually, since the earthquake. 53,000 Turkish people were killed And the destruction is just unimaginable. So what's happening here is from the south, we have the Arabian plate that's pushing north up against the Anatolian plate. The Anatolian plate can't move further north because you've got the Eurasian plate further to the north. So it's being squeezed on its eastern end and being pushed over to the west. Now we have also the North Anatolian fault line. And that's the fault line that runs right along the southern coast of the Black Sea, the northern part of Turkey. And if you go to the western end of that, it branches into three sections. The middle section runs straight through Nicaea. And it's because of seismic movement that, well, the lake has sunk in the eastern portion of it, thus submerging a church. Of course, as you know, people don't build churches underwater.
Right.
it's usually a really short Sunday.
Yeah. So they found this the basilica underwater. You talk about flying drones, if I remember correctly, over that part of the lake, and seeing what resembled a basilica with an apse, if I remember correctly.
Yes, I've got a drone, and part of my research involved flying the drone over the basilica. I got up very early in the morning so that there are few waves, so you get a clear picture. The water is very nice. You know, it's clear, so it's not muddy, and got a lot of really terrific shots of it, so you can see the layout. And that's important also for dating, for instance. And well, that helps a lot with research in many different ways.
Well, the book is fascinating, and so for those interested in archaeology and some of the challenges that it presents, but also some of the helpful evidence that it presents for the reliability of the historical accounts of the early church, this is definitely a book to get. Mark, as we're wrapping up here, tell us why, in your opinion, is archaeology important to early Christianity?
Well, to quote other archaeologists, you cannot understand the Old Testament or the New Testament unless you immerse yourself in the culture of the past. Our life today is so utterly different than life 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago, that it's hard for us to really put ourselves back into the past and understand what's going on. So archaeology fills in the gap. And even if it's archaeology that is not at a specifically biblical site that tells us about how people lived back in those days, naturally, as we read scripture, we assume that those people, well, we don't reckon or take into consideration travel. You know, we hop in a car and don't blink an eye about traveling an hour, 2 hours to another site. Paul was traveling literally thousands of miles on these missionary journeys. We think about the logistics. Where was he staying? Where was he getting food? And we take those things for granted, that there will always be a place to stay. There will always be food. Well, as Paul tells us on his journeys, he talks about hunger and thirst, exposure that he had to deal with. And so it really is the determination of Paul. It helps us to understand that these were not simple journeys. These were sacrifices that he was making. Why? Because he knew that the gospel message was so important. He was willing to forego a family. He never married. He didn't have children. He did not have a permanent residence. This was his life. And it inspires me to do more also. Now, when I travel Turkey, I'm not, you know, out in the open overnight in cold and exposure. I have food that I buy. You know, I'm not going through some of those difficulties that he experienced. But still.
Yeah.
Archaeology tells us about how life was lived back in those days, and so many things, even for that matter. We think about mentally, how do people think today? Today, people tend to be very much concerned about one's own personal needs, Okay, we are very much individualistic. And that's a problem. 2,000 years ago, we understand that the church was much more interested in the community. The community trumped individualism. What is good for the community is, you know, what people were doing.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Good. That's good stuff.
Mark, I think I was about to ask a question, but it seems like you have answered it. I guess let's limit it to Nicaea, since decades worth of research might be a much longer answer. What have the discoveries from Nicaea, how has that affected your personal faith? How have you been changed by what you have discovered?
Well, as I briefly mentioned a little bit earlier, I think I'm a little more ecumenical. I'm a little less harsh in criticizing people who disagree with me theologically. Now, don't get me wrong. We need to be firm on the foundation of the faith, the deity of Jesus Christ, the work of Christ on the cross, the importance of the scriptures. You know, those are some of the basics of the faith and the foundation of what we believe. But when it comes to baptismal practices, when it comes to eschatology, when it comes to church organization, some of the things that separate us into different denominations, those are peripheral. You know, and what we should do is embrace people who are of different denominations and say, look, you know, we are one church. And Nicaea was important because Constantine himself realized that it's not good to have a fractured church.
Yeah.
Bring everybody together and to concur and to agree on some of the foundations, some of the basics of the faith.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. Good, wise words from a wise scholar, archaeologist, adventurer. Mark, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you, Michael. And, God's best to you and your readers.
Oh, thank you so much. Aside from running to Amazon and looking up Dr. Mark Fairchild and trying to buy all the things that you have written, how can our readers keep up with the work that you are doing? I said readers because you said readers. How can our listeners? We're not doing a lot of reading these days on the podcast.
Yes. I don't do a lot of social media. The only social media I do is Facebook. And the only reason I did Facebook is because it's a good way to communicate to students and to family with one message instead of writing dozens of emails. So, I mean, you can find me on Facebook. Also, I've got a web page. It's called ancientbiblicalworld.com. Ancientbiblicalworld.com. I have posted many outlines of my lectures when I was teaching at the university, many of my publications, periodicals. There's PDFs that you can copy, download. So that's a way of keeping in touch with me as well. So check out the website.
Awesome. That is such a huge help, Mark. Thank you so much for being with us on the podcast. And we also want to thank y'all, our listeners, for spending your time with us too. This was your first podcast. Welcome. So glad you joined us on Ephesiology. I would invite you to go and check out the rest of our catalog, find a topic that interests you, and maybe dig a little bit deeper. What might we as the Ephesiology podcast have to offer you? Speaking of other things that we have to offer, please go to masterclasses.ephesiology.com. and see if what we have through online theological education is actually what God might be using to encourage you and spur you on to join him in what he is doing in your context. So for Michael, for Mark, and myself, thank you for doing theology in community with us today on the Ephesiology Podcast.